Hello, thanks for joining me for this segment of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment when you can high-five the person sitting next to you as you exclaim, "Yes, I'm in." I recently read a delightful little book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating, by Dr. Paul Oyer. Since I'm happily married for the last 36 years, online dating is not a topic that normally attracts my attention. Dr. Scott Schieffer, a guest on episode number 68, suggested I contact his co-author for the Roadside MBA about perhaps talking about his other book, which is what we're going to do. That other book is Everything I Ever Needed to Know. And I decided before contacting Dr. Oyer that I would read the book. And I enjoyed the book. I thought it was a very interesting take on economics and both online dating and its application in other areas of one's everyday life. And although I read it in the fall, and I'm recording this interview in January, I thought that economics and online dating would make a timely topic and show for the week of Valentine's Day. And fortunately, Dr. Oyer agreed. I also thought that a conversation with a Stanford GSB prof would be a good opportunity to explore life at Stanford GSB. So we're going to do both today. Before we dive into the interview with Dr. Oyer, I also want to remind my AST listeners that I invite your questions. If you have an admissions-related question, you can just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/90 and post your question in a comment. You can also send me questions via email to questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Again, that's questions@accepted.com. Now, today's question was posed on the blog by D_Singapore. She wrote, quote, "I'm pretty concerned about my GPA, which seems to be on the low side for HBS and Wharton. I went to a top three college in Asia, so it's pretty competitive there, plus all the extracurricular activities and side jobs I was involved in. Do you think I should explain the low GPA in my application?" All right, here is my response, only slightly modified from what I wrote on the blog. HBS and Wharton know how to interpret an international transcript. If you did well, in other words, if your grades are above average, there's nothing to explain or address. And frankly, if you did explain or address it, you might end up looking a little foolish. If you did not do well in the context of your school in your country, and there were factors that hampered your performance, then you can provide context. But be careful not to sound like you're whining or in the case of trying to explain something that doesn't need explaining, drawing attention to a non-issue. Now, you mentioned that you attributed what might be considered low grades to extracurricular activities and jobs. Those are two very different endeavors and two different, very different reasons or types of context for low grades. Having to work to support yourself or your family will definitely be considered a mitigating factor for a low GPA, or even a plus if you have a higher GPA. Whether your grades were high or low, you want the schools to know that you achieved whatever you achieved despite the serious time commitment and shouldering of responsibility. However, taking on lots of extracurricular activities to the point where those commitments harmed your grades implies to a school admissions committee that you didn't prioritize or manage your time well. So if you're going to point to those activities, you also need to show that you've learned to prioritize, learned to manage your time, and that maybe you acknowledge you didn't make the best use of your time or didn't do it appropriately in undergraduate school. Because otherwise the schools are going to, if you just say, "Well, I had all these extracurricular activities, look how great I was," and the schools are going to think, you might think the same behavior is going to be great in graduate school or graduate business education. So you need to show that you've since learned how to prioritize, how to manage your time, so that you don't have the same issue in graduate school. Thanks for the great question. Now, let me introduce today's guest, Dr. Paul Oyer, the Fred H. Merrill Professor of Economics at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Dr. Oyer earned his BA at Middlebury College, his MBA at Yale School of Management, and his MA and PhD in economics at Princeton. He taught at Kellogg from 1996 to 2000. He then left the Windy City for the sunshine of Palo Alto and California and has been at Stanford GSB ever since. Dr. Oyer is also the co-author of The Roadside MBA, which, like online dating, came out in 2014. And I'm going to guess that that means you were very busy writing those books in 2013. In 2014, just appeared busy. I interviewed one of The Roadside MBA's four co-authors, Dr. Scott Schieffer, in podcast number 68. And I'll link to that show from today's show notes, which you can find at info.exipa.com/90. Dr. Oyer, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm so glad you could make it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, this is particularly auspicious because while we are recording this in January, as I told you, I'm going to post it in Valentine's week. And I really couldn't think of any other way to somehow tie the topic matter of Admission Straight Talk and Valentine's Day without your book. So I really want to express my thanks for helping me out with that one. You might be an annual guest. I don't know. How did you come to write Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating?
Well, I didn't really plan to write a book ever, although I guess we'd already started down the Roadside MBA path before this. But what happened was I started online dating. So I went back to dating for the first time in 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I started by going online because that seemed like the way to meet people. And as I started the process, two big things had changed in my life in the 20 years between when I was previously looking for a significant other and when I started again in 2010. The two big changes were the rise of the internet and the way technology had changed everybody's daily life. And then the second thing was that I had become an economist. And these two things together had changed my outlook quite dramatically. So when I went back to start looking for a new significant other and started online dating, I mean, the fact that this was a market and looked very much like many of the other markets that had grown on the internet, be they Amazon or much more relevant since my expertise is as a labor economist, things like monster.com and LinkedIn and whatnot. So the parallels between that and online dating were, you know, just overwhelming. And at some point I said, well, you know, I always like to sort of explain the economics of everyday life to people. And I don't know, it just sort of grew from there. The actual idea of a book, of writing a book, came after I came back from my very first date. I emailed an old close friend of mine and mentioned, you know, sort of explained the experience. And she wrote back to me and said, wow, this is really interesting. You should turn this into a book. It would be sort of very mathy and all about economics and this and that. And I more or less did that, although there's no, I should point out for those who are scared by it, there is literally no math.
There's no math in it. None.
It's all intuitive economics in the end. But, you know, that's just kind of how it happened. And I just, it was a very easy book to write because I had to do a lot of research on the background papers and so forth that I discussed. But there's just so many natural intuitive links to between online dating, the job market, other things, and economics. And I should note that the title is a bit misleading in the sense that it's kind of a cheap way to get people interested in the book, but probably only a third or a quarter of the book is actually about online dating. The idea is to draw people into each economic concept through the lens of online dating, but then to let the many other examples where the same idea plays out be relevant, which is, I guess, why we're talking, since one of those applications I talk about is college admissions.
That's right. That's right. Now, I have five adult children, four of whom are married, and one is still looking for her significant other. And my dating days are long ago. My memories are fortunately frequently buried of dating. But but the marketplace analogy certainly makes sense to me. I mean, if you're in a place where, or on a campus where there are more men than women, you know, then the women rule the roost, basically. And if you're to the contrary, in a place where there are more women than men, men can be really picky.
Well, and that's when something I don't really get into in the book, but just a right. very basic supply and demand sense.
Absolutely. I was actually thinking about that. That was one thing you didn't get into in the book.
That's true. But age is a really important one. So how old is your daughter that's still looking for a significant other?
Mid-20s.
So she's fine, but, you know, it's really remarkable how 10, 15 years down the line, the numbers really start swinging.
Yeah.
So men become, the economics is the study of scarce resources, and a good mate is always a scarce resource, but the men become a scarcer and scarcer resource as we age. So women in their 40s have a much tougher time than men in their 40s or women in their 20s.
Makes sense. Now, you mentioned that the book was also somewhat mistitled in the sense that you use online dating as a springboard to discuss the applicability of economic concepts to a variety of non-obviously economic fields. But I thought it was somewhat misleading in another way, in that the official title of the book is Everything I Need to Know About Online Dating I Learned Everything I Need to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. But the way you write the book, it's much more Everything I Need to Know About Online Dating I Learned from Economics.
Yeah, so I actually wouldn't quite agree with that. I appreciate that. I'd say almost everything you need to know, or most of what you need to know, but not everything. And the reason I say that is economics is a very important part of the market, if you will, in this case. And it's a very important part of our lives every day in ways that I hope come out in the book and in the way I teach and so forth. But it's not everything. And especially when it comes to something as irrational as love, I really think that you need to think about this and you need to understand, if you really want to know everything about online dating, you need to know some psychology and sociology and the like. I can give you one very specific example where economics has a lot to say, but then has its limits, and we have to bring in the psychologists. And there's a chapter in the book called Cheap Talk, which is just an economist's way of saying people will lie when they have an incentive to lie. And so an example I talk through in the book is what are clearly rational lies. People know they know what the truth is and they exaggerate it. So age, height, income, weight is a great example. So all these things, and there's a lot of evidence suggesting that economic models of people lying when they have the certain incentives all plays out in online dating, and that's great. But the limit of economics is economics can only talk about this from the perspective of a rational liar. Somebody who says, I am 52, but I'm going to say I'm 49, and then I'm going to deal with the consequences later. I can't say I'm 39 because then that's too big a lie and I won't get away with it and so forth. So the book gets into that sort of thing. What the book doesn't get into and can't really get into, because economists have very little to say about this, is what I would call more irrational lying, or a better way of thinking about this is people lying to themselves.
Yeah.
So when I say I'm 52 and I write 49, okay, I'm chosen rationally to lie. Mm-hmm. But when if I'm a very depressed, unhappy person, but I don't perceive myself that way, and in my online profile I say I'm very optimistic and fun, that's a whole different kind of thing. And
as
economists, we just have nothing to say about that. And it's a very important part of the online dating thing. So I think I appreciate you trying to make that claim on my behalf that everything you need to know about online dating you can learn from economics, but I can't quite make – that's one of several examples where I can't quite make that claim with a straight face.
Okay. So there's no cheap talk here. And just to clarify that my point was not I certainly agree that everything you can't learn from economics, okay? But my point was more the way you structured the book, you were taking lessons from economics and applying them to online dating or to non marketplace scenarios, as opposed to the other way around, which is what's implied from the title.
Yeah, but, no, that's a fair point. I appreciate that. That's a good way of thinking about it.
Okay, no problem. I was also thinking in terms of people being completely unrealistic, that's not does not only take place in dating about themselves and their capabilities. Again, from my perspective, you know, people coming and thinking they are competitive at various top business schools, when any objective analysis of class profiles would tell them, no, you're not. It happens all the time.
Yeah, great example. And my kids have recently been through the college admissions process, and certainly they had friends who were not very realistic about where they should be applying in that case as well.
Right. All right. Now, do you feel that the concepts you discussed in terms of online dating are equally applicable to offline realm? And you mentioned other spheres also, but...
Yeah, I think they are. I think, sure, the basic idea applies quite nicely. I mean, the parallels aren't as obvious to things like online job boards or eBay anymore once you get to the regular context. But sure, I mean, cheap talk is a little bit, as going back to the cheap talk example, you know, the height and age lies and things like those. In person, when you're meeting in a more standard manner, you're going to tell different lies, or it's harder to lie, or so forth. But the same idea would certainly still apply. So sure, the basic ideas, economists have been studying the marriage and significant other market from an economic perspective since long before there was online dating. I mean, there's a guy who won the Nobel Prize recently, a guy named Gary Becker, and this was one of his many contributions, was thinking of the marriage market as a market. And you know, we really take the fun out of everything. There's just no question about that. We take all the fun out of a lot of stuff. But unfortunately, at the end of the day, at least I'm convinced that there's something to be learned by doing that. But we are. Nobody has ever accused anybody doing serious economic studies of being a romantic or fun or anything like that.
Well, as long as you know how to sell, to send roses, either the real or virtual variety, I guess you're sending the right signals, and that qualifies as romantic.
Exactly.
Now, chapter 4 of the book explores the concept of signaling, which you alluded to, I think, a minute ago, and then applied it not only to dating but to college admissions. Can you explain the concept of signaling and the connection to admissions, be it undergraduate or graduate?
Right. So let me explain the concept in a different context, and then we'll come to the college admissions example, which is, I think, just a wonderful application of it. So let's start with the job market. So the idea of signaling won a guy who used to be the dean here at Stanford Business School, Mike Spence. He won the Nobel Prize for this idea. And his model started from the assumption that all education is completely useless, that you learn nothing in school. Very ironic for a guy who was a business school dean and a Harvard and Stanford professor.
Mark Twain would have loved it.
Right. Now, I don't think he actually believed it, and there's a lot of evidence that it's not true. But if you take the model at its most primitive level, think of school as being a complete waste of time. But what it does is it separates the able people from the less able people. Uh-huh. So if you're very smart and you can do well in school, that proves to employers that you'll be productive. And so then by going to school, you waste time, you just waste resources. It's like flushing money and time down the toilet. But you separate yourself from those who can't do well in school. Or even if they could do well in school, the time and effort would be so costly to them that they don't even bother going to school. So that's the insight. What you need for a good signal is you need two conditions. One of them is it has to be costly. I have to be able to waste some resources in order to separate myself. And it has to be the case that it's more costly for the people who don't have the quality that you're trying to signal. So in the case of education, it has to be that education is a waste of time, but the people
and
the people who are going to be good employees are more able to get through, it's less costly to them. The reason I left out the money is The money is the same whether you're able or not, but the difficulty of going to college is higher if you're not as able. So that's the simple idea. Now, how would that play out in the dating context? Well, there was a study of it done in, you used the term virtual rose a second ago. This was a nice study done by a South Korean website where they said, okay, we're gonna allow people on our website for a period of time to start signaling. And what they meant is over any given period of time, each person on the website would get 2 virtual roses. And so this took the cheap talk of saying in an email, hey, I really want to meet you, you look great, which is just pure cheap talk. And we need to separate those people who send out hundreds of those messages from those who carefully scan people's profiles and pick people they are really a good match for. And by giving you only 2 of these virtual roses, you make it expensive. You put a cost on it.
You make it scarce.
You make it a scarce resource, exactly. And so then if you send this virtual rose, it takes cheap talk and makes it credible because you now say, hey, I really, you know, people look at this and they say, hey, this guy really does want to meet me or this woman really does want to meet me. And it worked very well on the website. Messages sent with a virtual rose were much more likely to lead to dates and relationships and things like that. In the and we use a very similar system, by the way, in the Economist job market. So the idea of signaling has played out to some degree in the dating and the job market, although I think there's a lot of opportunity to take it further. Now, coming to college admissions. So when you think that if all we're looking for as a college or a business school is the smartest, most able students, then signaling doesn't really matter because we don't care so much whether the person is a good fit for the school. If their SAT scores or their GMATs, that might tell us everything, and the recommendations, that might tell us everything we want to know. But suppose what we also really care about is among the set of many schools out there, we want people who have a reason to want to go to our school. We want students who really want to go to Stanford or really want to go to Washington University in St. Louis or wherever it is. So what we can do is we can ask those people to signal their interest by essentially wasting some time. And this used to happen quite naturally because when I applied to college back in the ancient days, each application was done on its own. I had to enter, you know, we had, I don't want to give away your age, but you might well have experienced this yourself.
Yes, I definitely did.
You took individual pieces of paper and filled them out for every college you applied to. And, you know, each one.
And if you wanted to get information, you had to put a letter in or a card in the mail and put a stamp on it and ask them to send you a catalog.
Right, you didn't have the World Wide Web. I forgot that part of it. It seems so ingrained in our lives. I've forgotten that we didn't used to have it.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you're younger. You didn't have to do that.
No, I definitely. I'm not. So all these things made it harder to sort of think through each school and to apply to each one. And so you were essentially signaling that you really wanted to go. You had a serious interest in this school by applying. And you would have to write individual essays for each school, and even if you could reuse the essays, you had to at least type them up again because you didn't have a computer to just change one word. So each of these things was harder on you, and as a result, you were able to separate yourself from those who didn't really care that much. I went to Middlebury College. You know, if you were not interested in going to a small liberal arts college in Vermont, you weren't going to take all that trouble to fill in that application. Now, if you look at current students in high school, they can apply to Middlebury with about 5 extra minutes of work because they take the essay and the common application has taken all of that individual college-specific work and said, okay, you know, it's just an extra $75 and you've applied to each school. Maybe they'll have their own essay, some little thing like that. And, you know, at the business school level, the number of essays and the ease of applying to more school has just gotten easier and easier thanks to technical changes. So there are 2 ways to fight against. So that might be fine, by the way, Before we get into whether how signaling can be of value, keep in mind that might be fine, because maybe students don't know anything about where they would be a good fit. And in that case, might as well make it as easy as possible for them to apply and let the admissions officers decide who's a good fit and who should go where. But if we do believe that students, either college seniors or business school applicants, we want them to think through carefully where they would be a good fit and focus their attention there, there's two ways to sort of make them do that work well in signaling. One of them is to not use as much of the common application. And a lot of schools have gone through a lot of existential angst about this. The example I use in the book is the University of Chicago, which stayed away from the common application for years and years and had very specific quirky essays and so forth.
Yeah, famous for it.
Exactly. And those were meant to make people think through, am I a good fit for Chicago? I have to prove that. It's costly to me in a way that somebody who doesn't want to go to Chicago will not be willing to bear the cost. And so it was a very effective signal. The other more standard way we use signaling, and there's a very nice academic paper about that by my Stanford colleague, John Levin, and a guy at Harvard Kennedy School named Chris Avery. And what they do is they analyze early admissions or early undergraduate early action and early admissions programs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another form of signaling.
It is a form of signaling. And why? You don't pay any extra to apply early, but you only get to apply early to one school, or most schools have it that way. There are various early admissions ways. But you only get one shot at this, and so it's a very scarce resource. Your decision about where to apply early is very important. My kids have just been through they're in college now, and when they went through, they thought very carefully about where they wanted to send their one signal, where they wanted to do their one early application. It's a critical decision because schools accept early admissions candidates at a much higher rate because those students have shown a special interest in the school. And so it plays out in the data. If you apply to a selective undergraduate institution, your chances of getting in are much better if you apply as an early decision student than if you apply as a regular admissions student. So it seems to be signaling in action. Now, at the MBA level, we don't have as much of that. We have, by the way, you have a little bit of signaling in any application process, more in the MBA than the others, just through the application fees.
That's changing. Not so much the fees. The fees, you're correct. But the amount of signaling specifically in business school has really gone down.
Right, right.
Way down. I mean,
right.
Now business schools take the GRE or the GMAT, where before it was just the GMAT. So there had to be a real commitment to the business school. And the GRE is also less expensive. Stanford, for example, has gone, when I was doing this in the late 90s or right around 2000, I don't remember exactly when it changed, Stanford's guidelines for essays were 3.5 to 7 pages each for essays, okay? Then they went to 4 shorter essays, which I think a combined total, I'm not sure, 1,600, 1,800 words. Today it's 2 essays with a combined total of 1,100 words. Harvard Business School used to have 6 essays, shorter essays, but essays. And now they have 1 optional. There's no required essay for Harvard. Some of this, I think, is because some of the information they're looking for has moved into, like, boxes on the application form as opposed to the essays. And some of it is, I think, basically ways to jack up application volume to make them the yield, you know, the acceptance rate go down, make them look more exclusive, et cetera. But And maybe they were not finding the information, I'm talking about the admissions offices right now, as valuable. But one way, there's no question that one way to jack up application volume is to make the cost of applying less by requiring less effort and time.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that's definitely offsetting, common application and these other changes in the MBA thing is definitely that rankings of schools are based on how many people get in. And that's a sad
How many apply? How many apply?
How many apply? What? Mm-hmm. Right. So, and that is a sad fact that leads schools to make it much lower cost to apply.
Medical school admissions, by the way, also has a common an initial common application, and the acceptance rates at medical school for the top medical schools are under 5%.
Wow.
It's so easy to just check that box. Then if the school is interested, then I have to do a secondary application, and that can be more work, more money. So there you have some more serious signaling. But anyway.
But I think you said two things that are very important here that make it, that, well, on the one hand, it's a set, if this is all driven by trying to game the rankings, that's a very sad situation. Now, on the other hand, the more positive outlook on it, and I'm not saying this is right, by the way, but if we want to try to feel more positive, there were two things you said that capture that. One is maybe over time there was information in essays and the like in the old days that has somehow found its way into that they figured out they can glean from the application without the essays. So maybe based on courses people took as an undergraduate or recommendations or something like that.
The other possibility is that the essays that they were finding in recent years weren't as valuable.
Yeah, right. Although if they were just getting people to waste time and prove they really wanted to apply, they would have been valuable even if you never read them.
As a matter of signaling, you're right. There's no question. They would be weeding people out because they don't want to have to do work.
The second possible positive interpretation is, you know, maybe business schools, let's just take the business school example. Maybe business schools aren't all that different.
Then,
so it doesn't really matter if you've thought through whether you fit at that business school. What's important is that you've thought carefully, yeah, I want to get an MBA, and then we might as well make it easy for you to get into the best possible school because it's not that different, except, you know, maybe you have preferences on a regional basis, but, you know, so be it.
Yeah, but then if it's regional, then you'll just apply to the schools in the region that you're most interested in or with the most hiring ties to that school. So that's another possibility for sure. As you were writing the book, let's go back to the book for a moment. We'll leave MBA admissions. What was the most surprising connection for you between online dating and economics? Or was there a surprise?
Yeah, not too, you know, again, I'm really like preaching to the converted when I think about this stuff. Nothing really surprised me about there being a connection. I mean, it's always nice, and I would say the same, by the way, I'm going to give you the same answer I would give you if you'd asked about the roadside MBA book.
Okay.
What's really nice about both these contexts is just, as somebody who's such a believer in economics, just to see how economics really plays out in the real world the way we expect it to as economists is just fantastic. And the fact that, you know, the importance of thick markets and the value of signaling and the way people use cheap talk and other stuff, the fact that you just see it in the data and the analysis, thinking through the way the world, like an economist, that it really plays out in this very seemingly non-economic marketplace, I don't know if I found that surprising, but I just found it fantastic. I mean, things like the value of, there's a chapter in the book about returns to skill and how, you know, if you're in the labor market, there are certain returns to education, and you can just see the same forces playing out in the online dating market, where if you have certain skills, they just get rewarded, not by money, of course, but by dates.
All right. Now let's move away a little bit from your online dating book to some of your more current research, because I saw in your bio that you are currently studying how firms identify and recruit workers in highly skilled and competitive labor markets with a focus on the markets for newly minted lawyers and MBAs. Now, those two fields right now are about as opposite, I think, as you can get in terms of demand, supply and demand. So how does that play out?
Well, it's a very good point. Unfortunately, our lawyer work was back before the dip in the market. So it's hard to draw distinctions. You know, there's a really interesting difference between these two markets, which must have something to do with signaling, or not exactly signaling, but employment matching in important economic ways that I've never quite figured out. And that is, if you look at the MBA market, studied the MBA market quite a bit, and if you look, you know, most students who go to a traditional two-year MBA, and, you know, that's a withering population, as I'm sure you know. The two-year MBA is really pulled. The traditional full-time two-year MBA has become much smaller over time. But if you look at that population, they tend to, of course, have a summer internship between the 2 years.
Right.
And if you look at least at the relatively prestigious schools that I've studied, that I've had the good fortune to get data from to study, you find that, you know, if you get a summer internship, there's a good chance you'll get offered a job to come back full time, maybe even over 50%.
Right.
But, you know, it's far from a given. It's you know, 50% maybe of people get offered jobs. So if a big consulting firm goes and hires, you know, 100 summer interns, they're not going to hire all 100 of them back. You know, even a, they might hire, they have more capacity, so they might hire 60 or 80, or, I mean, 60 or 70 of them back, but they're going to use the information they glean over the summer to make some decisions. Traditionally, and this may have changed as the market has softened for lawyers, that's very different. The law market is very different. And at least as of a few years ago, before the recession really changed the market, if you got a summer internship at a big law firm, you got a full-time job there. Like, you had to do something nearly criminal over the summer to avoid getting a full-time offer. And I've never understood quite why that is, because I feel, you know, when I think about employment relationships from an economic perspective, you think you want to use the information you're learning at each step in the process to determine whether the match is good or not. And either these lawyers are so good at determining whether a match is good before they hire the person, just based on the transcript, that they never have to, that they can always make them a full-time offer over the summer, or they're just so afraid of getting a bad reputation on campus if they don't follow through with an offer for somebody that historically they've just always given offers. And I don't quite know why that difference is, but it's a glaring difference between those two markets.
Right. It's interesting. I hadn't realized. I mean, I know that not all MBAs get offers, and that also they don't always accept the offer. They might decide they want to go do something else.
Well, that's definitely true, sure. In both of those markets, that's definitely true.
Right. But I think that later is more common in the business school market. I think they're much more fluid in some regards.
Yeah, these differences might have to do with the fact that different jobs coming out of business school are just very different from the jobs coming out of law school.
The opportunities are so much more varied.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you go to a big law firm, they're different, but not really.
Yeah.
So if you
work like a dog either way.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, if you don't go to a big consulting firm, sure, you can go to another big consulting firm, which is similar, but you could also go to a bank, you could go to a startup, you can go to work for a big company. So the options are quite different.
Right. Now, let's turn from you as an author and expert on the connection between economics and online dating, or personal economics and human markets, to your role as an economics professor at Stanford GSB for the last 14 years. When you reflect on your students at Stanford, are there any characteristics that you feel define the Stanford GSB student? Is there any common thread? Is the signaling working in some way that you can discern?
Well, so we're really fortunate, of course. I mean, just, you know, I feel incredibly lucky that we have always had so much demand for a spot in the Stanford Business School class is truly a scarce resource.
Yes, absolutely.
We've been very lucky to be able to therefore have just, you know, really remarkable students who've achieved a great deal. And when I say that, I mean that pretty broadly. We always have, in every class, we have really smart people, but then I'm always amazed at the other talents our students have. You know, things like when they do the annual show, in terms of just the production of video and things like that. It's amazing what some of these people have done and can still do. So having said that, the defining characteristic, at least, you know, the defining characteristic at Stanford, and this was true when I worked at Kellogg too, is just, you know, very able, high-achieving people who are book smart, but tend to also have some other type of skill that's valuable in, you know, one way or another. So I think that's a defining characteristic. Now, I would say over time, Stanford has certainly become more oriented towards entrepreneurship and tech startups just because of where we are. We tend to draw those types of people, and even when we don't, when people come here, they tend to be drawn to that because those opportunities exist here more than in other places. But I think that trend is true across all top business schools, more and more of a focus on entrepreneurship and technology. You know, we're probably out in front of that a little bit more than other places, but
absolutely.
I think that's a broad trend.
Okay. All right. How has writing this book, the online dating book, and the Roadside MBA changed the way you teach economics and strategy?
Yeah, I mean, it's just given me countless examples and ways to show people. When I teach economics, for example, I use both books in that class. As optional reading. I don't like to force people to buy my books. I like to suggest they buy them. And
no signaling there, right?
Right. But you know, even if they don't read the book, just using examples from the book has just been, you know, fantastic for helping me relate to ideas. So let me give you a very you know, I talk about and work through the idea of signaling and the idea of cheap talk as well in my core economics class when I teach that class.
Right.
And I certainly use examples from the book to bring that to life and to get away from the underlying math that I'm asking people to learn as well, to relate that math to the real world.
Sure.
So it's been helpful for that. The Roadside MBA has also been incredibly helpful. For example, when I work out as one just very simple example, I used to make up a price discrimination example, and it was just kind of a corny example from, you know, widgets or something like that. And now I just take literally the price discrimination example from the book, which is about dog daycare, and I just make up numbers to go along with it. And so then you can really tie the underlying mathematical modeling that I'm trying to teach in the class to something that's much more practical.
Right. Right, for sure. I was just thinking my husband was trying to help our grandson with fractions. He's in fifth grade, and he was struggling with it. And my daughter told me that he insisted to her he was never, ever going to use fractions again in his life, and what relevance did they have to him? Fourth grade, whatever. So, yeah. So being able to take a real world, you know, real life example, which we provided our grandson, but would be it would just bring your class to life. There's no question about
it. Now, having said that, at the end of the day, I still hear people who are much older than 5 years old say, "I'm never going to do this again in my life. I don't have to learn it."
Right. you've been teaching MBA students for a while. What do you wish your students had done or learned before they arrived in your classrooms?
It's a very good question. I think I have one. Coming, those who don't know any math, I would like them to have spent a little time boning up on that over the summer. And it's really hard to do that. So I'm very sympathetic to the fact that they don't. But it just, there are a lot of people, we overwhelm people with quantitative material in the first few months here at school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just feel like if people could really get prepared, though many people don't need to get prepared for that. You know, they're more than prepared, either engineers or economics majors, things like that.
Right.
But there are a lot of others who just don't fully appreciate until they're in that they're going to be drinking, you know, the proverbial drinking from a fire hose. And it's really hard to prepare for that before you come here. I don't know exactly, you know, how you would do it. You'd probably want to use some online things like the Khan Academy or so forth. But just to get comfortable so that when somebody says, "We're going to take the derivative of x squared now," you don't freak out.
Yeah.
You know, that would help. you know, the derivative of x squared is 2x, which isn't really that hard, but people lose it when they have to do that. So,
my husband is an actuary, and I was a social and political science major as an undergrad. So when I got to business school, yeah, I was one of those people who did not have a math background. And I took a class called Mathematics for Business or something like that, and I think we had 1 or 2 weeks of calculus. That was my total sum of calculus study. So my husband was trying to explain something to me one day, and he didn't want to use any calculus because he knew he always made fun of this class. I took. He was very dismissive of it. And so he was trying to explain that something was increasing at an increasing rate. And I said to him, you're trying to tell me that the first derivative was positive, second derivative was positive. And he looked at me like he was absolutely shocked. He says, how did you know that? And I said, well, I took this, you know, the class you're making fun of all the time. So this is still a dialogue going on. But
I love when people say things like that.
Yeah, I could have knocked him over with a feather, all right? But yeah, there's also something called MBAMath.com where people can brush up on their math skills before taking an MBA, and it's actually an online course designed by a professor at Tuck, Dartmouth Tuck.
And there are a variety of things. I didn't know about that. I'll look at that.
Yeah, that's a fairly low, inexpensive course. It is paid, unlike the Khan Academy, but it's specifically a curriculum designed to prepare people for business school.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing I would say is not so much what they should do to prepare as to think about their attitude when they come here. I mean, I think students, when they come for a full-time MBA, I think they should think of it. People are always very excited to be here and to do the millions of things that are open to them. But I think they should try to remember, you know, at least if you're going to the types of places I've had the good fortune to teach, like Northwestern and Stanford, I think you should remember that those 2 years you're getting your MBA, those are your last chance to be in graduate school at a top, you know, for most people at least. You're in graduate school at a top research university, and, you know, take advantage of that. There are so many classes to be taken and so many lectures to go to that are going to teach you things. And, you know, if you give up one little networking or one party to go hear something that really makes you think deeply, you know, I just encourage people to do that more. You know, because it's graduate school at a top university. And if you think of it that way, rather than just sort of a way to look for my next, in addition to a way to get a great job after I graduate, I think that's really helps make the 2 years more valuable.
That's a great, great point. And there's a tremendous investment in those 2 years. So
yeah,
you know, it makes sense. All right, Dr. Oyer, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Again, I enjoyed everything that I ever needed to know about economics. I learned from online dating, even though I'm not dating, as well as our conversation this morning. Where can listeners learn more about and purchase online dating and economics?
Oh, if you just Google Paul Oyer online dating, you will have many opportunities to purchase it. And also, there are various online coverage of the book that, you know, people may or may not be interested in. Since Valentine's Day is coming up, I'll tell you that it's a year old now, but I had a column on the New York Times website back in preparation for Valentine's Day 2014, where I gave people Valentine's Day advice from the economist's perspective.
That is
an opportunity I'm sure many of your listeners would just die to take advantage of.
Okay, we'll try and find that and include a link in the show notes. And you can find the show notes at info.exhibit.com/90, and we'll include links both to Dr. Oyer's book, and we'll try and find this article so we can link to that too. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Oyer and me for our 90th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. If it's been helpful to you, then again, it helps us if you do leave that review, because iTunes will rank a Mission Straight Talk more prominently if it has more reviews. And if you have a question for me, please leave it at info.accept.com/90 or by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.